Now, with all that, please join me in welcoming Dr. Dwight Burlingame.
Good morning. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. Can I?
Sure.
Do we have to go by script, right?
For sure.
It's really a pleasure to be here, and really, 7 o'clock in the morning, that's good. I think that's tremendous that you can have your coffee together in this kind of conversation. It really reminds me of the whole notion of a commons and thinking about how this country over so many hundreds of years actually built upon a nation built upon the notion of the commons where we have this kind of dialogue. Everybody coming together regardless what your background was, what your history is, what your nationality is, or what your race is. It's all having that conversation in a civil way. And I can't think of a better way to have a civil conversation than 7 o'clock in the morning with a coffee cup. So it's great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Dwight. And thank you for coming in yesterday. We spent the afternoon together. We had a three-hour dinner with a group of folks in the community and lots of conversation, and you'll be on In the Moment today at 10 o'clock on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Thanks for taking all the time with us. To start off, would you describe philanthropy in two sentences? And yeah, let's start there.
Okay, I'll try to do two sentences. This is difficult. I've already done two. Philanthropy is voluntary action intended for the public good. What's action? Action is giving, volunteering, advocating, participating in society for the betterment of humankind. And of course, in the Latin definition, I've gotten now to four sentences, maybe six. So is what? Philanthropia. And philanthropia translated into English basically means love of humankind. And when you think of the Christian traditions, we have, what is it built upon? Agape, love. So you know, really helping others for the betterment of society.
Dwight, you've shared examples of philanthropy from your life, and I'm hoping that you'll be willing to share some of those this morning of the earliest forms of philanthropy in your life.
As many of you probably have all, I'm from a rural community in north central Minnesota, and I started my mornings getting up and helping with chores. This was a dairy farm with, I don't know if you really want to call it a dairy farm. It was a farm, attempting to have a farm, very small, had animals, cows, so we call it a dairy farm. But limited. And so we were very poor. We lived off the earth. We did our hunting. We gained our, you know, got all of our food through natural ways, and engaged in a process where my mother was Catholic, my father was not, and so part of the requirement of a young child at age six, I needed to start contributing at Sunday in church and put in my dime. Initially, she gave me the dime, but once I was able to make some money in terms of, I was an entrepreneur. How did I make that money? I made it by trapping gophers. And the township provided 25 cents for a pair of gophers' feet. And so out of that earned income that I had, 10 cents every Sunday had to go into the collection plate for the activities of the church, which of course was on the White Earth reservation where we lived. And the so that really was my first introduction to philanthropy. It was required. It was not voluntary. You can be quite assured I was not too happy about giving up. You know, that 10 cents was a pretty high proportion of what I was getting every week in the trapping season in terms of the gophers. So, you know, that was significant. But that changed in terms of, it's an important thing. Once you have the tradition, once you build that notion of why are you doing it, which you learn as you get older, and you see other people helping you. I was a recipient for, until I graduated from college, I was always a recipient of philanthropy from someone else. And so it wasn't until, you know, I gained the capacity that I became, if you will, in terms of giving of resources. Even in those early days, I really experienced being a philanthropist. I just didn't know it. I didn't have a name for it. I didn't call it that. You know, I helped out when other people needed help. If somebody had to build a new barn in our community, you know, all of the people in that community went and helped. They were doing philanthropy in a really major way. And so I think those traditions are very important. So when you don't have that kind of culture going on, how do you change? And that's what I've really devoted my life to, is then, you know, educating about philanthropy.
Thanks, Dwight. If we pick up right there, your early career was a practitioner. You were the president of the university's foundation. You entered into the academic world with this background. You've authored 10 books, approximately 60 articles, served as the editor of leading academic journals, helped to formalize the nonprofit sector, and established the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at Indiana University. Would you talk about this career path a little bit?
I'll just do a little prior to becoming president at the foundation, excuse me, at Bowling Green State University and vice president for university relations. Prior to that, I was a dean of libraries and learning resources. And prior to that, my first career really started when I graduated from college. I was a high school teacher. some of you in this room probably have been in an education for at least some time during your life. Why was I doing that, I think, is a good beginning point, just very briefly. Mm-hmm. And it was my mother, who was born in 1919, she graduated from Bemidji Teachers College, and it was a 9-month training program, and she became a elementary teacher in one room schools, of which I went to school in for 6 years. I was the valedictorian of my class, and want you to know. There were two people in my class. So in grade school. And the, but you think about my then, so I had that life, and my educational career in terms of then going on and getting my master's degree and starting at the University of Iowa, I was drafted into the military. And I ended up in the finance corps as my primary responsibility after I learned how to kill people. It was a turning point in how I looked at the larger notion in terms of how society works. I mean, I will admit, I was very opposed to the Vietnam War. I felt it wasn't a productive, and the more I was in the Army, the more convinced I was that this was not a war that we should be in because what was happening. Because I got assigned to Letterman General Hospital in San Francisco to be an assistant in surgery. Basically, what I did was, sucked up the blood in the surgery process. Who were they operating on? They were all service members coming back from Vietnam with reconstruction of their, primarily we, the unit I was in was facial reconstruction. And when you are working on these people and doing this, you ask the question, why is this, right? Why is this? And what good is this doing? And I know, so that takes moving forward and thinking about other contemporary wars that we continue to be in, and you ask the question, what's the role of philanthropy? If we really believe philanthropy is, as I do, voluntary action for the public good, how does war help us? So you mull over those questions, and it just causes me then to say, what can I do? What can be my legacy? What can I accomplish? How can I change that? And I think education is fundamentally the way that I decided to start working on a program. And I got convinced in the opportunity to go and join Indiana University to help start this center on and develop a curriculum for college students. And we have 3-degree programs, et cetera, and educating people about fundraising by taking, and some of you maybe have had the opportunity to take the fundraising school. Has anybody in this group gone to the fundraising school by chance? Well, we're missing, right. And I have. For Hank Rosso, who started it with 2 other men in California, had this really simple thing. What is fundraising? Why are you doing it? And he just simply said, actualizing the joy of giving. That's what, if you're in nonprofits and you think about it, you are agents if you're in the nonprofit, and if you're in the donor community, and all of us are one time or the other, we also give, right? I mean, we might be a donor, the next hour we might be a fundraiser, asking for a particular something, providing that opportunity to actualize this joy of giving that you give, I mean, that you get from giving and helping. It's in our DNA. And so maximizing that at the same time that we know in our DNA is self-preservation, right? Self-interest. We have to be self-interested in order to have resources to be able to help others. I mean, if you just totally help someone else and do nothing to build your own interest, self-interest, in terms of your own feelings of accomplishment and joy, et cetera, so I always thinking about philanthropy is really recognizing that it's both self-interested and it's also interested in helping others. So in the human condition, we have both. And so how we go about maximizing those elements, I think, is from a beginning recognition that to be altruistic, totally altruistic is, you know, is that even possible? Economists would say, in current arguments, some of you probably, I have to mention this about economists, but Harry Truman, as you may have heard this, said, economists are always commenting on, well, on the one hand, and on the other hand, and Harry Truman's comment, I remember this, reading this was such a great comment. What's a good economist? One that only has one hand. So never mind this notion. So this economist that told me this question, or actually not, but they call this warm glow that one gets when they are helping others, that helps yourself. Because economists really think about rational behavior, and for them, rational behavior means competing for resources in the, you know, economy, and so that you'd obviously want to get more resources or help yourself. So they finally figured out why are all these people giving money away when they're not, you know, it doesn't seem rational. And they came up with warm glow, which we as humanists, most, probably most of you in this room, knew that already, but they put a name to it. And so you have to study a couple years in order to be able to know, you know, warm glow.
Dwight.
Sorry, I'm...
So you're good, you're good.
You'll forgive me for my... Yeah, I'll pay more attention to your question.
No, no, don't worry about it. We have an academic hour. We have 50 minutes, and you... It's your show. So we have a lot of, there's a lot of nonprofit leaders and practitioners and participants in the here to this morning. You talk about warm glow, you talk about joy, the what a fundraiser does is bring joy to giving. So can I ask the very practical question? What are the three steps to do that? To be a good fundraiser, to be able to bring joy to somebody's giving, to meet your needs as a nonprofit. What would be the three proven methods?
Well, first of all, there's more than three steps.
Could you repeat that? Does it take more than three visits to a donor to make an ask?
Yes, before that happens, you have to have had seven thank yous.
Yes, could you explain that? We use this in our work. And I just want to thank you for being here.
So let me see. You've
that would be
me,
a good.
I think five times. So you're going to ask me for some support? Two more times?
Publicly, too.
No.
A little pressure.
No. I think the first is really to take an appreciation in fundraising, whether it's looking at corporate or business, whether you're looking at doing grants, whether you're looking at individual solicitation, and it's especially important in what I would call significant gifts of significance. And I want to emphasize that gifts of significance does not mean gifts of large dollar amount. A gift of significance can be as little as a bar mitzvah, where the young man going through bar mitzvah says, all my gifts, I want to go to this charitable cause. And that can become truly a gift of significance in the life of that individual. So what does that mean? Giving to, number one, knowing as a fundraiser who your mission as an organization, one, right? And how you identify with others who share that mission, that advocacy. So it's not going and asking, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates for some money. You know, that's the most ridiculous method of fundraising. But sometimes people start out, well, why aren't we asking, in the case of South Dakota, well, why aren't we getting money from Sanford? I think he's your only billionaire, right, in the state? I'm not sure, but I think he's, somewhere I've read that he was the only billionaire in South Dakota. He's invaded Minnesota, too, by the way. I should say his health systems have invaded Minnesota. And in the little community where I'm from, in a rural community, they came in and bought up the St. Joseph's Hospital. I'm not suggesting that's bad, by the way. I just want to, it was just an editorial comment. So knowing who shares your mission is certainly number one. So then how do you go and do what we would call the development process, the education process of gaining appreciation and identifying the people that share your mission. Well, the only way, I think, well, one of the only ways, there's more than one, several ways, but fundamentally, it's building a relationship. And building relationships, having volunteer opportunities, having engagement opportunities, where you're really engaging the people in what you're all about. And so that fundamentally gets to person in significant gifts. And so you ask the question, how do you really do that in the age that we're now in? Electronics and, you know, the internet, social media. How do you do that kind of engagement in social media? The best thing to do is ask the people who are using social media. And there's been, which I want to reference, and this seems like appropriate time. There's, for the last 10 years, there's been going on a millennial impact report being written and funded by a firm called Achieve, who's a former student of mine, who's been the CEO. He just left Achieve and starting another new nonprofit. And in the Millennial Impact Report, it really goes into this whole how you invigorate a generation for causes and social issues, i.e. for supporting nonprofits that you all represent. At the same time that you maintain your significant donors and engage them in the work of your organization. So I refer you to the 2017 Millennial Impact Report. It's available online. It's really, I think, a good in thinking about the new generation and how you utilize the new social media, especially, and how they want to be engaged in organizations. And it's not volunteering 5 days a week, 5 hours a week or 5 hours even a month necessarily. For the same organization. And so the national, there's a group at University of Maryland, another former student of mine who heads the program at Learning, they call themselves, it's the Do Good Institute, and it's campus-wide at the University of Maryland. A man by the name of Robert Grimm, who runs that program there, who graduated from our program about 15 years ago. They have been looking at, he worked for the National Corporation for Community Service, in the federal government, and the FIRST, and they did these biennial surveys of volunteering in the U.S. So it's like 260,000 people that are in their sample. And so it's reasonably good statistically and representatively about from the country. And they have found that volunteering since 2003 by young people has declined. It hit the all-time high, which is right after 9/11, 2 years after. It has declined. And high school volunteering has taken a decline, about 2.6% in terms of their last look at the data, which was 2016 data. Maybe it was 15. There's a two-year lag. I think it's 2015. And they are asking the question, why is this happening? And the because we know if you're engaged, if you're volunteering with an organization, you're much more likely to give. You're 4 times more likely to give, and on a consistent basis.
Can you repeat that? If you are engaged, you're 4 times as likely. If you're volunteering on a consistent basis with a nonprofit, the likelihood is 4 times greater.
Yes. This is based upon the independent sector studies of several years ago, and then there have been follow-up studies in terms of participation rate. This is true in religious giving as well. If you're in the pew, regular attendance, and of course regular attendance in the best collection of statistical information on churches is actually done, well, is now being done by at Purdue University in Indiana, where they have this huge database. It's a hard thing to get a hold of, since churches don't, of course, have to report. They're not required to. They do a lot of denominational surveying, and previous source was an organization in Illinois, did collection of this data, but it showed in their data, and they had a pretty significant amount, that people who participated at least once a month were in the pew, they gave 4 times more than someone who wasn't in the pew, who was a member of that.
So Dwight, if I know just from meeting with nonprofits that there's an idea that I can meet with you 3 times, on the 3rd time I need to ask you for a gift. But what you just shared is that if you're engaged and it's proven and over again, that if you're regularly engaged, which potentially could be 1 time a month of engagement, you're 4 times more likely to say yes to me when I ask you. So a good fundraiser.
Or you're 4 times more likely to give more.
To give more.
Than, you know, just a one-off gift.
There you go.
You know.
Yeah.
It's been nice knowing you. And here, I'm going to kiss you goodbye. Here's your gift.
Get out of here. Can we jump? I want to jump.
If you don't have a relationship, I mean, that won't happen. And so it doesn't matter if it's, you know, 3 times is not a magic number at all.
I think it is for some. I mean, that's right. People are repeating it, that it's, but,
right.
but you're sharing.
Think ultimately, the quality of engagement is so important.
Yeah.
It might be a year. It might be once.
Can we, I want to put the nonprofit sector that you have helped define and formalize into perspective in our society, at least in the United States. We have 3 sectors. We'll start with 3 sectors. Maybe we'll end with the 4th. For-profit, government, nonprofit. Can you talk about the importance and the uniqueness maybe of the nonprofit sector in the United States a little bit? Give us baseline, please.
And in the academic study, and this comes before we had, you know, schools of philanthropy or nonprofit, which is relatively recent in this country. I mean, the first one started actually at Pompeo at Yale in 1978. And I have been a proponent. I've tried to teach this in all of my classes for the last 30 years at Indiana. And going against what's in the textbook, because the textbook has put forth this notion of 3 sectors. I fundamentally believe there are 4 primary sectors. And the first sector is not government. The first sector is not business or the commercial sector. And it is the household. It's the family. When you think about this is a sociological, construction in the first place. And so if you think from what happens and how do you get services? So we're talking about, if you think of the middle circle here, we have education, we have health, we have spiritual need, et cetera, in terms of to have a healthy life, you need all these things. And so you draw that inside circle of services being provided, and then you look at where does it come from? And it comes from government elements provide some of that, business you know, economic, financial need comes from the what I'm going to call the corporate sector or business sector, commercial sector maybe would be better, and then the government, commercial, and then we have nonprofit. This is the way it usually goes, is the third sector, and then the fourth, household. But if you really think about it, where did it all start? It started in communities of families, providing the education, providing the welfare needs, providing health, all of those services. And then we had, and today, if you ask the same question, where does your children get their education before they go to school? In the household, from the family. Where do they get their moral compass initially? It's in the household. And so, and this notion of family or family sector, you know, that's extended family. I'm including all the various stripes of families here. And so whether it's single or multi or neighbor family, you know, so traditions. And so I think it's really important to think of four sectors in when we talk about it from a sociological perspective and focus in on the family and how much they do. Where does healthcare come from, for goodness sake? You gotta have family engagement. You know, right now I am taking care of when I'm home. My wife needs 24-hour care because of a stroke that she had and was paralyzed on part of her body. And the, so it's not the nonprofit sector that's providing that. It's the family. Think of all the families who take care of their elder parents until they no longer can, and then they go into an institutional setting of a nonprofit or a government. But they're still providing, you know, these services that one needs. I think of education today. It just proportionally, when you think of the amount of time when children are in school and then the other, well, 6 hours generally, probably in a day, when you are going to school, 5 days a week, what's happening in all that other time? Where's that facilitation of education coming from? The household. It's true in philanthropy as well, right? How the family models their giving, their volunteering, the priority, the values you give. What would we do without the household?
Dwight, who is the most important?
Have I convinced anybody? We've got four sectors. Sorry.
Who's the most important philanthropist in your life?
I cannot answer that question. I don't have one most important, I don't think. There have been many. I would have to probably, if you really pushed me on this, in terms of if you really want to push me, I'd probably say my mother. Because it was that requirement, and it was the expression of thinking about, we're not in the absolute worst situation. There are other people that need your dime more than you do. Mm-hmm. And that her interest in humanity, I'll tell you one more little story about that. As some of you know, if you were raised in the Catholic tradition, the Marinol campaign would go on every year, and we'd get our envelope from church, which was for help abroad, for the missions abroad. And it was always put into the context of how much others needed the support and what you could do. And in those particular time, well, that was once a year, my commitment went up to a dollar. It wasn't just a dime. But this was a whole year, you know, I had to have that dollar. And I think the notion that, I think that probably, you know, that expression of caring for someone else is probably, from a mentor perspective, was the most important in formation. So I've had many other mentors in my professional life. One of my most important in philanthropy was actually a donor at, I mean, she's dead now, so I think I can, I'm happy to say her name. Her name was Virginia Stranahan. She lived in Perrysburg, Toledo, Ohio. She was the, she was the mother of the family philanthropy. The Stranahans are the folks who made their money in Champion Spark Plug. That's where they got their money. And it was, you know, she was certainly one of the wealthiest people, the Stranahan family, and she divorced her husband. They set up, and she had six children, a couple of them out here west in Denver, still live out here, I mean, live in Boulder, and are engaged in their philanthropic activity. But she became, she took me under her wing in understanding the perception and the perspective of a donor in a community like Toledo, where everybody knew, and she was, you know, solicited constantly. She just didn't get one letter or one request in the mail a day. She had at least four or five every single day. And we would go on a retreat to Chautauqua in New York. I don't know if any of you have been to Chautauqua, but this whole Chautauqua tradition of having the retreat was mainly designed for teachers and people of, well, at that point in the early beginning, of course, was Christian persons. And it's now expanded to both Jewish and Islam, actually, now at Chautauqua in New York. And so we'd go there every summer. We'd spend the week or 2 weeks together and just have great conversations over all of the life and how can we continue. And her guiding me in thinking about how one can understand the appreciation of those who do have greater access and their responsibility, and those who have virtually nothing. And it was just a, she really built in me a, what I would call a compassion that I will always thank her for that. So at her funeral, I mean, it wasn't your traditional funeral. Virginia was not a traditional person. We had it at her estate in Perrysburg, and we released a eagle, American eagle, that had been nursed back to health. And with that process of, you know, the flying of the spirit symbolized in the release of the life that Virginia had led and helped so many people, it was just symbolically, those kinds of things stick with you. Mm-hmm. And whenever I think about maybe not being quite as patient as I should be, I just have to think about her. And it gives me a dose of spiritual, what I'm going to call spiritual energy. But there are many others who, in various degrees, you know, Robert Payton was one in, when who hired me at Indiana to come and build this program. I only worked with him for 4 years, and then he retired, and he's of course now dead as well. But the his preaching to me, I mean, he adopted me. I was one of his disciples. If you want to take the analogy of Bob loved to get disciples convinced of. And of course, he his definition, this voluntary action for the public good, that comes from Robert Peyton. I revised that definition and added what I thought was a really important addition of voluntary action intended for the public good. Because there's a lot of philanthropy that people have good intentions, but it may end up being misanthropy. You probably know some cases of misanthropy. So I think that's...
Will you give 30 seconds on misanthropy? And
it's,
then I've got like...
Right. Using your resources not for the good of for the love of humankind.
Intended or...
So voluntary action basically not intended for the public good.
Would you share the best piece of advice that's been given to you?
You didn't give me that question ahead of time.
No. We're way off script.
Should we get more on script?
No.
No, we should ask the audience. No.
Oh, I have an audience question, but let's go back.
Okay. No,
Is there a piece of advice?
I don't think the... it's very hard when you try to say the single most important piece of advice you get. I mean, you get a lot of advice. And at one point, it's the timing of it that's so important. I think it's the timing. So knowing how to act on that advice and doing it at the timing of it and the situation that you're in, that's when it becomes most important at that particular time. But it certainly changes. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to pass on that question.
Would you talk about what's a sign of a good fundraiser, a good characteristic of a good fundraiser? What's the first thing?
The most important thing, without a doubt, is the ability to listen.
And of a donor?
The ability to listen.
Dwight, could you talk a little bit
because
about...
Because every fundraiser is a donor. And most donors are fundraisers. In fact, we have a tendency to convert our donors into fundraisers for our organization, don't we? And we have a strong tendency, fundraisers in the past, have had a strong tendency to want to advertise their donors and not let them be anonymous. So, and of course, the reason why you want to advertise your donors, put them in your program and thank them all, and so everybody else is sitting at the whatever organization it is, you get the annual report, you've got all the donors listed. You might see a couple that are anonymous who really don't want to do that. But we want them to do it because to let other people know that they're committed to your organization. Right? So you want to help them, you're trying to help them appreciate for other people to know that they value what you're doing in terms of your organization. So I spent a lot of time talking about anonymous giving, and so I won't go there, but...
Would you talk a little bit about...
Listening.
Thanks. Would you talk a little bit about, and this is another topic that I know comes up in this community, donor fatigue?
Yes.
Thanks.
I have fatigue with organizations in terms of their asking of me. I really don't have, in the true sense of being a donor, I don't have fatigue in my giving. My giving, I'm not fatigued about at all. And I would guess most of you aren't. What you're fatigued with, including myself, and why it gets this name, donor fatigue, is really fatigue with how you're being approached. And right now in America, I don't know about you, but in Indiana, I'm extremely fatigued with the political harassment that I'm getting from candidates for office. And I'm calling it harassment because I can't get away from it. Every 20 minutes, if I'm watching an evening news program, what comes on? I'm Todd Rokita. I'm going to make America right. I'm going to straighten it out. I'm going there to do blah, blah, blah. And you know, you do all of it, just, and I'm, of course, it's, I couldn't help it. I apologize for that. But it just, you know, and it comes every 20 minutes. And so it's the asking and the approach that you really become fatigued with. And I get 40, 50 emails a day. You know, requests from, how did I get on this list? Well, it's obviously, whether it's Republican or Democrat, it doesn't really matter. You're extreme, you get really fatigued. But it's the fatigue of the process. If you ask me in terms of being a donor and my capacity to actualize more gifts and what I choose to make and do as a donor, I don't have fatigue. I get a lot of warm glow. So I think that's, it's just sorting out that the opportunity that people try to maximize their, you know, taking opportunity. So I feel fatigued with the process, not being a donor.
This is a question that came in over email. Is there a difference in effectiveness between large gifts, which go to support institutions and endowments, and gifts which more directly aid those in need? This person said, I think of a microloan program which seems to reap substantial benefits in many places. Is philanthropy too often understood as larger gifts to large places when small and local might be a better way to serve? You talked a little bit about that earlier.
Well, I think the it's certainly contextual. And yes, I think we put way too much emphasis on the large donors and the large in terms of dollar amount to an organization. And it's often, it's the potential of the large donor. And so you're looking at capacity only. And any good fundraiser, I think this is what you were probably trying to get at in the previous question, in looking at, in, you know, capacity, engagement, and interest in the cause. So you have to have those three things. And so capacity is only one. And if you don't have all three of those, your likelihood for success is going to be greatly diminished. So, and so you look around you and think about all of the people who might have an interest in a particular topic. And so, or organization, your cause, and asking the question, how do we make that match in a way that will get results? And often, it isn't necessarily the dollar amount. I'm not minimizing the power that goes with money. and which is a real problem, in my view, in the U.S. today, especially when you look at the political system and how wealth is used for power. In a democracy that we all believe, you know, we all should have equal opportunity, but quite frankly, we don't have equal opportunity. And that's particularly true when we look at poverty and its increased rate in the U.S. and the distribution between the rich and the poor. Who needs, you know, $10 billion? Who needs that? What can be the possible reason for that? You only need that if you are focused in on power. And in a democracy, we're fundamentally interested, you know, that's perfectly fine for the royal family in England, and they've maintained that position, right? And when you look at the dictatorships in the world, but when you look at the democratic capitalist democracies in the world, the notion is one vote, having equal power, and, I mean, representation in the group. And so when you have a democratic notion, how do we actualize that?
Dwight, can we?
Yeah. Which is going off. I know we're.
No, that's okay. We have 5 minutes. There is a number of things that came up yesterday. One being on what you were just saying, I think in line with what you were just saying, a study you referenced, you pointed out yesterday, that was done. If you're born in 1940 or between 1940 and 1950, the likelihood that you're going to do financially better than your folks was 90%? Is that what it was?
Yes, if you were born actually before, 1945-ish. Before, correct.
90% chance of
correct
exceeding your folks', your parents', financial place. If you're in 1968 or 1960s, that number dropped.
Last part. Yeah, it dropped down to 50%, 40% decline. In that, your children, if you were born in that period, you would be less likely to do better than your parents. In terms of capacity, I mean, in my case, in my family, I was born in 45, and I did extraordinarily well in the sense of compared to my parents. It wasn't a hard thing to do in the sense of opportunities that I was given, all philanthropically. However, if I look at my children, I have two children, a boy and a girl, and they are now 47, and my son will be 50 next year. They are not doing as good as mom and dad did. And you look at contemporary ones, and across the country, ability to actualize the American dream, which of course for many of us, at least it was for me, was to own a home and be able to send your kids to school and just even community college. You know, today it's really, especially community college, in thinking about having a living because of so many of the getting a livable wage in the service industries today, you can't survive on $10 an hour. Anybody who thinks that's the case just is not done it. There's a great book on living on a dime a day, that's what the title was. A woman who tried to do this, she gave up, she was coming from a wealthy family, and she went out there and tried to live on working at McDonald's, et cetera. Approach. She lasted for a year and a half and that was it. And it was really, when you think about that, of just the whole notion. If all of our billionaires did a very simple thing, we know this is not going to happen, right? But if they took that excess billion and distributed it to the entire population and brought them up for work at $15 an hour, that's minimum wage, in this tax deduction that the wealthy just got in the new tax bill, 87% went to the wealthy, the top, both corporate and personal. And when we talk about corporate, we know, you know, that's shareholders. And who has shares in corporations in America? You know, 80% of the population has no shares. They're not in the stock market. And that's where this excess is going. So they give a $1,000 bonus, or a couple companies have done that. Look at Boeing aircraft. You know, they gave 1,000. Whoopee, as a bonus to their employee. If you would redistribute the notion in terms of just being sure that everyone that's working, I'm not suggesting for, you know, sloth. I'm suggesting for people who are able-bodied workers. If they made $15 an hour, this change, they wouldn't be able to get rid of that excess billion when you multiply it times the number. Wouldn't that be radical? But gee, it'd be easy.
Dwight, we've talked about...
I'm not a communist, or I'm not a... I just want this. No. I was born a Republican.
So we've talked about philanthropy. I'm trying to get past that. We talked about philanthropy and generosity. So I have this question. We've got a lot of examples of philanthropy and generosity. This is the last question. There are a lot of acts of generosity. There's philanthropic acts. And what I hear you say in the last years and yesterday and today, the question is philanthropy, is generosity a characteristic of living a life? Is it an approach to life? Or is it a list of acts?
Well, that's an easy question for me. I think it's obviously it's approach to life. And when I say approach to life, it's actualizing, you know, the DNA that we have. The empathy and compassion that we all enjoy in different degrees, of course. And philanthropy is, so many wise people before us over the centuries have articulated, what's the greatest virtue? Assuming most of you in this room are probably out of the Christian tradition, or maybe out of the Native, I don't know, do we have some who are the Native American tradition? But it's actually expressed there as well. The greatest virtue is love. So that's a way of life. But it gets expressed in acts, right?
Dwight, we've had almost 40 people over the last 4 years here. Never anybody that has helped define and formalize a field of knowledge in the world that's based in love. Thank you for taking time to be with us those last 2 days. Thank you for the conversation today. Personally, thank you for all your guidance and support. We have a piece of art from the Black Hills Work Susie Kappa Art Center. We're an art center for artists of all abilities. We hope it finds a place on a wall And you remember Rapid City? So we hope you enjoy this piece of art and finds a place in your home or office.
Wonderful.
And thank you so much for being here with us today. Thanks everybody for coming. Really appreciate it.
I really am appreciative and want to just leave with you in the art tradition. My interest in art has been often in music. So, philanthropy, voluntary action intended for the public good. Philanthropy. Thank you all for coming.